Trump at the UN today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump's uneasy relationship with the United Nations comes to a head this week. He's in New York for the UN General Assembly.
Everybody has been a bit anxious about, you know, what President Trump might say.
A preview of the week ahead at UN headquarters. Plus, volunteers learn how to help when immigration officers knock on a neighbor's door.
The dispatcher is sending out a text. Okay? Saying, can you respond? You text back, OTW, on the way.
And the dangerous letters East Germans wrote to the BBC during the Cold War.
There's no escape. We vote for who we're told to. We're simply a herd of cattle which must obey.
Those stories ahead, today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us this Monday. This week, we'll see a homecoming of sorts for President Trump. He's spending several days in New York City. Hasn't been there that much since taking office. But this is not the kind of visit where he just gets to relax in his Trump Tower penthouse. Trump's in town to attend the United Nations General Assembly, his initiation as president to this annual meeting. So we're checking in with our friend Colm Lynch here at the top of the show to see what the mood is like. Colm covers the UN for Foreign Policy magazine.
Everybody has been a bit anxious about, you know, what President Trump might say. There is a bit of concern that he might go off script, that he might, you know, rattle some nerves. But so far, we got our first glimpse of him this morning. He spoke to a group of world leaders alongside the Secretary General, talking about UN reform. It was a meeting hosted by the U.S. And he was pretty much on his best behavior. He mentioned, I mean, I guess sort of the ultimate form of flattery for Trump is that he noted that the luxury building that he built about a decade ago across the street from the UN couldn't have succeeded as well as it had if it hadn't been for the United Nations being across the street. Then he went back to his script and, you know, said all the nice platitudes about, you know, how important UN reform is and how the Secretary General is doing a fantastic job. And I think one of the things other UN delegates are trying to do is to create as, you know, inviting an atmosphere as possible here for Trump so that he doesn't go off script.
Mm. So they're trying to kind of like accommodate him and anything that might go off script. So what's on the agenda this week? What is Trump focused on?
Iran, climate change will be issues that everybody else will be focused on, and the United States will be less so. So there are a couple of big high-level meetings on climate change. President Trump won't attend. The American administration won't attend. So part of the push from other delegations is to get the Americans to sort of reverse course or at least show some softening in terms of its positions on the one hand climate change, but also on Iran, and to try to get the Americans not to, you know, throw out the sort of landmark 2015 nuclear agreement with Iran. So those have been kind of the most controversial issues, but you also have at the same time North Korea.
Right.
There's going to be quite a bit of focus on Burma and, you know, the military's crackdown on Rohingya Muslims and the flight of large numbers of refugees. So that's going to be a big issue. Other ones, Syria, Iraq, you know, grappling with the question of whether the Kurds go ahead with a referendum on separation from Iraq. So a lot of big issues.
Colm, I see that the U.S. delegation at the UN General Assembly this year is smaller when you compare it to past years. What kind of message is that sending? And do you think it will affect diplomatic efforts in anything, in North Korea, Iran?
Well, for instance, one department, the State Department, the Department of the DRL, which deals with issues of democracy and human rights, they asked to send, you know, somebody from their office to the UN to do the work that they do on human rights. They haven't been allowed to send a delegation. So, you know, that sort of reinforces a message that human rights is not a main priority. I mean, I think there was always a sense that the U.S. delegation didn't need to be as big as it was, but there's a lot of diplomatic work that the various bureaus of the State Department engage in that, you know, you don't see at the General Assembly debates. And I think, you know, people who follow this think that those are valuable opportunities to do, you know, an enormous amount of diplomatic work in a very short period of time. You know, you're there, everybody's in one place together. You don't have to travel to foreign capitals. So maybe it doesn't really save costs. So I think, I mean, the broad message is that particularly the State Department is retreating. But what that has done in some sense is that it's just elevated the role of the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, and in a way she seems to be kind of eclipsing the State Department and Tillerson and seems to be having kind of a stronger voice.
Colm Lynch covers the U.N. for Foreign Policy magazine. Ambassador Haley's performance at the U.N. has also caught the attention of Susan Glasser. She's chief international affairs columnist at Politico. We caught up with Glasser in between meetings in New York.
Nikki Haley has been a very forceful spokesperson for the U.S., for Trump. She has not done some of the things that people worried about perhaps at the beginning of Trump's term, right? She's continued to assert a leadership position. She's organized sanctions meetings when it comes to latest North Korea provocation and the like. So she's been a fairly active and extremely high profile UN ambassador. I think that to me is one of the interesting surprises so far of the administration.
How would you say she's accomplished that? Because it's a delicate balance, isn't it? Getting things done at the UN and representing a president who sees little value in the UN.
Well, that's right. In a way, perhaps because he sees little value in it and it is not obviously inclined towards complicated multi-party, multilateral diplomacy, that has enabled her really to be a more public-facing presence and a spokesperson for the administration's foreign policy.
So if you had to give Nikki Haley a report card for how she's been doing at the UN, how would you grade her so far?
Look, the incomplete is the grade overall for the Trump administration.
A big eye.
There are too many questions still remaining. And in fact, as I go around and talk with people here, that's the thing that's striking, right, is that almost 9 months into the presidency, we don't know answers to basic questions about this administration's view of the world and its relationship with its partners. And so that is still a big question mark. So Ambassador Haley talks tough, for example, on Russia and Ukraine, but we still actually have no idea what the administration's policy is going to end up being on Ukraine.
Is it your sense that she is her own person and she thinks for herself and she doesn't really wait for Trump or Tillerson to kind of give her the memo?
Clearly, she is a proactive person. She's also a politician. And I think lots of people think she's a very ambitious politician who's looking to see if there's a space for her in national politics. And certainly, she's radically increased her visibility and profile over the last couple years. And, a lot of people wonder if she's using this as a springboard either to a future job as Secretary of State in the Trump administration or going back to electoral politics in 2020 or beyond.
Susan Glasser, the chief international affairs columnist for Politico, speaking with us in the neighborhood of the UN, not too far away. Susan, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
As the Trump administration continues its crackdown on undocumented immigrants, immigration activists are organizing in opposition. For example, some people are stepping up to support their immigrant neighbors and help them avoid deportation. The World's Monica Campbell saw one effort underway in San Jose, California.
The idea started with Violeta Roman's story. It was before dawn, 2014, and Roman was already at work. Then her daughter called sobbing.
Y me habla llorando. Yo dije, ¿qué pasó? Porque no podía ni hablar.
I asked her what was wrong. The police are here, she said. They're taking grandpa away.
Entonces yo le dije a mi compañero, le dije, llévame porque la policía se está llevando a mi papá.
Roman got a coworker to rush her home, but it was too late. Her father, from Mexico, was already cuffed and being driven away by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers. A quick operation, 15 minutes. Roman ran to her church for help, finding a lawyer, and neighbors accompanied her dad to court.
Yo me hice el compromiso de la, y la decisión de, después de que a mí me acompañaron, acompañar a otras personas.
Roman says she vowed to help other families feel supported too. So she's helped build what are called rapid response networks. Networks now being replicated in other cities across the U.S. They include hotlines for urgent legal advice if immigration is at the door, and volunteers ready to come witness arrests and support families afterward. Sitting with Ramon is Lorena Melgarejo. She's with the San Francisco Catholic Archdiocese and is helping build the networks too. She says they expand on the idea of providing sanctuary.
Instead of this idea of the sanctuary churches being inside of the walls of the church, being actually this idea of us being the sanctuary in the streets.
To see this up close, I go to a church in San Jose, California, in a heavily immigrant part of the city. It's evening, and about 50 people are sitting in folding chairs, ready to get trained. Father Steve Brown kicks things off.
How are you all today?
Good.
Do you know, can you hear me? I got a big mouth. Is it good? Okay, good.
Celine Dinjanel, an immigration lawyer, starts the training, going over basic rights if ICE knocks on the door.
So what rights do you think that immigrants have in raids? They can remain silent. Great. And where does that right come from? The Constitution, and it applies to everyone. It doesn't matter what your immigration background is. You have the right to remain silent. And why?
Then it's how volunteers should respond if they get a text message that ICE might be arresting someone nearby at their home or work.
The dispatcher is sending out a text to volunteers, maybe in the 2-mile radius. Okay? So you, observers, would get a text saying, can you respond? If you can go, you text back OTW, on the way.
Volunteers also learn about taking on different roles once they arrive at the scene, taking video, notes. Then the group role plays. One volunteer pretends to be an ICE agent. Others pretend to show up.
Okay, action.
Open up. What are you doing? Can you please stop recording?
I can scoot back, but I'm not going to stop recording.
Please scoot back a bit further.
I'm scooting back, but I'm not going to stop recording.
Okay, yay! How did camera person number one do?
Great! Yeah.
But it's one thing to practice this at a church. It's another to be on the street when an arrest is actually happening. Jesus Ruiz, one of the trainers, recommends caution.
When you get out of the car, have your phone out already. The last thing you want to do is be approaching ICE and reaching in the back pocket for your phone. Especially if you're a person of color, we do not recommend that.
They're also clear what this group is not doing.
We're not trying to stop a deportation. We're not going to interfere with ICE because we are putting ourselves in danger of being arrested.
Volunteer Patty McDonald says she's ready. She's an elementary school principal.
I work with a lot of immigrant families through my job. Children telling me that their parents are afraid. I feel hopeful that there's something I can do rather than sitting worried and angry. And I feel like I can be part of something that will support them.
How do you feel about being, you know, jumping in your car perhaps at 4 or 5 in the morning and rushing over?
That's something that I can do, and I would like to do that to support my community.
For Violeta Roman, who we heard from earlier, the networks also mean closing a gap. She knows people, like her dad, who've been deported, but she says that's not the case for many of her neighbors in San Francisco.
No es lo mismo escucharlo a verlo.
She says it's not the same hearing about what's happening, more immigration arrests, families being split, as it is seeing it up close. For The World, Monica Campbell, San Jose, California.
Coming up on the show, two stories about Germany, then and now, looking out and looking in on The World.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
It's a brown president looking into the eyes of brown people, saying that I acknowledge what our government has done.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. One of the perks of being partners with the BBC is being able to share some of their great reporting with you, stories you might not otherwise hear, like this one from my BBC colleague, Abby Darcy.
Today I'm taking you back to communist East Germany in 1968 and the story of a German schoolboy arrested for writing letters to the BBC in protest at the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. Troops had gone into the country at the end of August to crush an uprising against Soviet rule. Across the border in East Germany, a schoolboy, Karl-Heinz Borchardt, was secretly listening to the radio.
Das waren Beschreibungen, dass die sowjetischen Panzer...
I was hearing about Soviet tanks rolling into Wenceslas Square. It was really emotional. I sat down at my parents' sitting room table and I wrote my first letter.
Sehr geehrte Mitarbeiter des deutschen Programms von Radio London. Ich bin noch nicht lange Hörer Ihrer Sendung.
To the staff of Radio London's German service. I have only just started listening to your program, but I like it a lot, since it airs opinions you don't find in our media. I'm 16 years old. I will write to you regularly, mainly about young people and their views on world affairs. In my view, the West did not intervene strongly enough in Czechoslovakia. Does a country which fought so hard for its freedom have to carry on marching to the tune of the Soviets? Warm regards from a schoolboy.
Es grüßt Sie herzlich, Ihr schreibender Schüler.
Karl-Heinz signed off using a code name. He wrote a West Berlin address on the envelope and dropped it in the postbox. He hoped it would reach the BBC's German radio service and be aired on Briefe ohne Unterschrift, or Letters Without Signatures, a programme devoted to airing opinions from East Germans. Yet he did this at great personal risk. Listening to, let alone writing to, a foreign broadcaster was a criminal offence in the communist GDR.
Here is England.
Since World War II, the BBC had broadcast a German service on shortwave, and Letters Without Signatures was one of its most popular programmes.
Ich glaube, dass Engländer nicht auf Befehl einer fremden Macht auf Engländer schießen würden.
It was introduced by an English presenter, Austin Harrison, and broadcast anonymous letters sent in by listeners from the GDR.
The voice with the English accent, that was Letters Without Signatures. It was how he commented on the letters, with ease and skill, and the variety of views you heard. I was looking for like-minded people, and writing the letters was a release.
Listeners would write about life in the communist GDR, about political oppression or food shortages, things they wouldn't usually risk saying openly. But here, their voices were anonymous.
We are being educated in lies. I can't tell truth and lies apart anymore. The whole world is dishonest. Politics is just a lying contest. What's the point of life?
We're being held in a huge concentration camp. There's no escape. We vote for who we're told to. We're simply a herd of cattle which must obey.
Other correspondents sang the praises of life under the system. Günter Burkhardt was an assistant on the programme.
Harrison treated them all equally. They were listeners. Whether they had one opinion or the opposite opinion didn't matter to him. I think this was the great strength of the programme. People had the feeling they were talking to a human being. A nice, sympathetic voice with an English accent, of course. He talked about us, you know, the family, he and his listeners.
Karl-Heinz's letter never reached the programme. It was intercepted by the Stasi, East Germany's secret police. The Stasi viewed the programme as dangerous propaganda, and they were so determined to stop it that they set up a unit to track down letter writers. Saliva samples were taken from the envelopes. They traced fingerprints from the paper, sourced the ink, and built up an archive of handwriting samples. It was his handwriting that caught out Karl-Heinz.
Das war eine ganz normale Aufgabe, wie ich zunächst annahm.
I thought it was just ordinary homework. The teacher asked us to write an essay about our personal development and explain what job we'd like to do. My father thought I had such terrible handwriting. He wanted my sister to write it up for me. He nearly got his way. But in the end, I wrote it up again with better handwriting.
The essays were passed on to the Stasi. Unaware, Karl-Heinz sat down to his next letter.
Sehr geehrter Mr. Harrison, ich bin 17 Jahre alt, also in diesem
Dear Mr. Harrison, I am 17 years old. I grew up in this country, but don't think it's fun, always having to say the opposite of what you think. My honest opinion is that only violence will help us. If Hitler had been overthrown by the people, millions of lives would have been saved. Warm regards, a schoolboy.
Oh, I could hide 'neath the wings of the bluebird as she sings.
Ich lag also morgens noch im Bett, das war der letzte.
I was lying in bed on the last day of the summer holidays. I'd just turned 18. The Monkees were on. I was even listening to Western radio when they came to arrest me. 5 Stasi agents came in 2 cars. I started going over things in my head. At that moment, I really didn't know what it was about.
Karl Heinz was later sentenced to 2 years for attempted subversive activities with a so-called enemy broadcaster. He says it could have been a lot worse. Still, life in the youth prison meant daily violence and hard physical labour.
Wir mussten im Gasgerätewerk das Haus arbeiten.
We were sent to work in a factory making gas appliances. It was a huge place with basically no safety regulations. None of us really knew how the machines worked. I was lucky, but there were a lot of injuries.
In 1974, Letters Without Signatures was taken off the air by the BBC. Former producer Günter Burkhardt still doesn't know quite why the programme was withdrawn.
I think the number of letters reduced anyway, whether people didn't write anymore or whether more were caught. It may be that there were, let's say, hints from the Foreign Office. Perhaps it was thought that, you know, with diplomatic relations coming up and recognition of the GDR, that it was time to end it.
With the end of the show, Karl Heinz stopped listening to the BBC altogether. For the next 15 years, he worked as an electronics engineer, later got a PhD in East German literature, and then a low-status university job. It was only after the collapse of communism and the reunification of Germany that he could begin working as an academic at Greifswald University. He is still lecturing in German literature there today.
Incredible story. The BBC's Abby Darcy with the tale of Karl-Heinz Borchardt, who was a teenager when he was arrested by East Germany's secret police for writing letters to the BBC.
I like words.
A podcast.
Elegant, flowery words.
About language.
Tonsorial.
The world in words.
Grapple, jostle.
The world in words.
Crunchy, crackly words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Here is a mystery sound. And here's a clue.
You're standing on an iceberg that's 100 miles long and 20 miles wide. And it's sort of like, oh, you know, nothing is going on here, but then you feel your feet vibrating.
Turning moving ice into music. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. There is a generation of kids in Germany who don't remember their country being run by a man. They've only lived under one German chancellor, and she is Angela Merkel. She's been in power for 12 straight years now, and she's favored to win another election this weekend. But here's an interesting parallel to keep in mind. Just as Barack Obama was not able to single-handedly erase structural racism in this country, Merkel hasn't magically made sexism disappear in Germany. Katrin Ben-Hold has reported on that for the New York Times.
Women are still paid 21% less than men in Germany, which is worse than the EU average of 16%. Partly this is due to the fact that a lot of women are in jobs that aren't terribly high status jobs, so they're not really climbing the career ladder as much as women in other countries. Now, this is, of course, a problem that we see across the world and across the Western world, but it seems particularly stubborn in Germany and particularly surprising in a way, considering that, as you just mentioned, for the last 12 years, we've had a woman hold the highest office. However, below her, women have a hard time climbing still.
Why do you think that is? I mean, is there something structural there that Angela Merkel herself is just unable to deal with?
there's definitely a long history of celebrating motherhood as something very defining in Germany in a way that perhaps is unique. You know, we have the three Ks, Kinder, Küche, children, three words that start with a K in German, which define the female role inside the house. The Nazis sort of celebrated motherhood, giving mothers of multiple children medals. And then the division of Germany after the Second World War in East Germany, where men were then leaving the country in droves and there was a real shortage of labor, the communist regime wanted women to work. They needed female labor. And when Western wives still had to ask permission from their husbands to go to work, Eastern women had 1 year paid maternity leaves. They had shorter hours if they nursed. In West Germany, where Angela Merkel's Christian Democrat Party ruled, the three Ks was revived. It was a country that had lost its moral compass, that was looking for stability. The church provided that, and with it, that very conservative image of the family and of the wife and of the mother was resurrected.
I gather there's been some pushback to feminist concerns in Germany. Can you just talk a bit about gender hype or gender wahn?
So this is one of the new words in sort of German language, gender wahn, that basically means gender madness. And it's a language that's used by the far right minorities that vote for people like the Alternative für Deutschland, the AfD, a party that believes in very conservative values, that is also anti-immigration. The image of women is very much traditional and some would argue sexist. So there is a backlash, interestingly, despite the fact that actually, if you look at the figures, the progress has been really very limited. There are more CEOs in Germany called Thomas than there are women CEOs.
That's incredible. You know, given the victor in the U.S. election over a woman and his way of talking about women, I'm wondering how you see the differences between Germany and the U.S. Where is each country at with their openness to women running the executive?
I would say that there are two very different approaches of the feminist movements in Germany and the U.S. I think it's really interesting the way that Hillary Clinton claimed the term feminist for herself and made her campaign in part about the rights of women. Angela Merkel has never really called herself a feminist. And I think one reason she hasn't is that she knows it would put people off. The term feminist today in Germany is a very negative term still.
So the election is this weekend, Katrin. Are these issues being talked about? Are people having a conversation around them?
No, it's not an issue really in this election. Angela Merkel has a lot of issues to deal with. A refugee crisis, a Greek crisis in the European Union. This is not on the front burner.
Yeah, one could imagine, though, this might be her last term. Could she go kind of hell-bent for leather and make this an issue?
You know, it's pure speculation, but there are people, there are feminists in particular in Germany that hope she will, that in some ways, as Obama arguably did become more outspoken about race in his second term, perhaps Merkel will become bolder on it too. And so I suppose her fourth term will be when we find out.
Katrin Benhold with The New York Times, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The latest episode of our language podcast, The World in Words, focuses on the German election and on one word in particular. That word is, Patrick Cox?
Volk. V-O-L-K.
Right. So that's the German equivalent of the English word folk. I bet the story doesn't end there, though.
No, it may sound like a simple word, but Germans, they don't agree on what that word means.
They don't? Why not?
Well, you have to go back in time. Volk has been around for hundreds of years, and in that time it's picked up all kinds of shades of meaning. The key moment was in the 19th century before Germany as a nation existed, and German nationalists used the word to describe German-speaking people scattered all across Europe. And they also used an adjective, a derivative of Volk, which became quite popular around that time, Völkisch. That came to mean national, but in a very specific ethnic way. So it didn't include, say, Jews.
Okay, so I get why people might not agree about how these expressions are used today. But what about the Nazis? Didn't they use these terms a lot? I mean, like, there was Volkswagen.
Oh, yeah. And they had the perfect vehicle in the German language, which naturally builds these compound words, you know, long words built up of shorter ones. And they went to town adding to the already long list of Volk compounds. So let me play you a little bit from the podcast where we talk about this. This picks up the story on Adolf Hitler's 44th birthday, April 20th, 1933. Hitler and the Nazis had just taken total control of Germany's government. And they were now making moves to control how people thought, how they spoke. Victor Klemperer, he was a German academic, a linguist. He was documenting all of this. He kept a diary throughout the Nazi years, and he was especially focused on the way the Nazis were using words. This was part of his entry for that day, April 20th, 1933. The term Volk, he writes, is now as customary in spoken and written language as salt at table. Everything is spiced with a soupçon of Volk. Volksfest, festival of the people. Volksgenosse, comrade of the people. Volksgemeinschaft, community of the people. Volksnah, one of the people. Volksfremd, alien to the people. Volksentstammt, descended from the people.
Patrick, that's incredible. It kind of became like the prefix of the Third Reich, this word, Volk. The Nazis just twisted this whole sense of the people and made it Aryan, like the white master race. Were these words forbidden after Germany lost the war?
Well, they weren't so much forbidden as people just avoided using them just because they were tainted with these Nazi associations. But what's interesting about that now is that with the rise of right-wing and anti-immigrant groups in Germany, some of these words are making a comeback. And people are beginning to return to this older definition of the word Volk that is closer to the Nazi one.
Yeah, how so? Can you give me an example?
Well, let me take you to the streets of Dresden in eastern Germany.
All right.
Ich meine unseren Volksverräter und Lügenminister Demisier.
This is a Pegida rally. You may have heard of Pegida. They made a lot of international headlines about 3 years ago. Pegida is an acronym in German. It stands for Patriotic Europeans Against the Islamicization of the West. They took to the streets of German cities, especially in the former East Germany. They were protesting the massive influx of refugees from the Middle East. And back then, they would regularly attract 30,000 demonstrators. That's no longer the case. But there are rallies most Monday evenings in Dresden. On the evening that I went, there were about 2,000 people singing and marching.
Da macht lasst uns alle streben.
Many of the protesters are in their 50s and 60s. They're brandishing right-wing themed flags and T-shirts with all manner of slogans. One guy, he was a local car dealer. He was wearing a Stetson hat and a Donald Trump T-shirt. And among just a handful of them is also some Nazi paraphernalia. Just a handful of them. Like Charlotte Raufuss. She's in her 20s. She's wearing all black with neo-Nazi tattoos and a Wehrmacht T-shirt with the words Heroes for Germany. Charlotte tells me she's wearing this in honor of her grandfather who fought in the Wehrmacht, the Nazi-era army, but has since felt shamed by it. I asked her to define the word Volk.
Ein Volk einfach als eine Gemeinschaft beschreiben, ähnlich wie es meine Vorrednerin schon getan hat.
Volk means a community of the same ethnicity with the same values, she says. So, not immigrants. If two Muslims live in Germany and have a child, she says, that doesn't make the child German. It's like saying that a dog born in a horse stable is a horse. It doesn't make sense. Germany, she tells me, needs to re-establish its purity. Most others, they aren't that extreme when I ask them about the word Volk, but they all seem to restrict who belongs and who doesn't. Here's Renata Schneider, a sweet-looking old lady wearing a white lace cardigan.
Das deutsche Volk, das sind laut Definition.
The German folk, she says, are, by definition, people with the same culture, who speak the same language, who live here within a defined territory. This is the folk. Renata has experience with the word. She's from the city of Leipzig, which in 1989 is where protests began in East Germany that months later led to the downfall of communism. Wir sind das Volk, those protesters chanted. We are the people. We went on the streets in 1989, Renata says, for freedom and unity, for German sovereignty. But now, more than 25 years later, we see that Germany isn't sovereign at all. And our leader, Frau Merkel, she represents European and global interests, not German. These protesters, every last one I spoke to, said they'd definitely be voting in the upcoming election, voting for the AfD, the Alternative für Deutschland, the Alternative for Germany. It's a new party that has won seats in state parliaments, but not as yet in the national parliament, the Bundestag. If the opinion polls hold, the AfD has a shot at becoming the third largest political party in Germany.
That's incredible. So the far right in Germany is on the rise, and it sounds like they're trying to redefine this whole sense of who the German people are, who the Volk are. Has Angela Merkel responded to this at all?
Yeah. Earlier this year, after months of being criticized for just avoiding using the term Volk altogether, she gave the speech in which she attacked these groups, Pegida, the AfD, and other right-wing groups, and said that they had no right to define Volk in ethnic terms. She said, Das Volk is quite simply everyone who lives in Germany.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel there asserting that the people of her country are das Volk. They are the folk. All right. You know our podcast about language. It is The World in Words. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts or at PRI.org/language. You can find it there too. Patrick Cox, thanks.
You're welcome, Marco.
Germany's not the only European country wrestling with identity issues. So is Sweden. And like Germany, Sweden has seen a recent influx of migrants, many of them from Syria. My BBC colleague Nuala McGovern spoke with three women who are rebuilding their lives in Sweden.
My name is Silva Youssef. I came from Aleppo, Syria. We came in the beginning of the war here in Sweden. I came with my children. I have two sons. In the beginning, it was very difficult. And after, now it's very good. I learned the Swedish language. And after I began to work here, after 6 months, the restaurant's owner, Hans, said to me, I will buy this. I said, okay, can I speak with my father? So my father helped me. And now I'm...
So you're the owner?
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah. But it's very nice. In the Aleppo, I was not working. I was sitting at home. And when you come here, you must to work, you must to do something. You can't sit home.
I'm 24 years old. We've been exactly 2 years, 2 days in Sweden. I just love Sweden.
So what's life like for you here?
Well, for now, studying Swedish, of course, but mostly mingling with my friends.
Are your friends Syrian or Swedish?
Well, actually, we have friends from all over the world, but I have quite a few Swedish friends, too.
What would you say are the differences or, you know, how Swedish girls live their lives compared to the Syrian girls that you knew back home?
Well, obviously, there is a lot of differences since our society is a little bit more religious and a little more confined. But to me, it wasn't because I wasn't raised the normal Syrian way. My mother has always been open-minded, so I've always done what I thought was right. And that's kind of Swedish, in a way.
I'm a teacher now.
But you also have children, you said?
Yes, I have a triplet.
You have triplets?
Yes.
Your husband, you say, is Syrian-Palestinian and now also Swedish. Has he changed at all in the time here?
Quite a lot. Actually... We have been blessed with the triplets, and when we came here, they were 1 year, 10 months old, with diapers and all the thing. So he had to be engaged 100% anyway. But of course, the society had a lot of effect here. It helps a lot. And to be honest, now when he's sometimes surrounded with a lot of newcomers, then he kind of goes backwards a little bit, because he feels... Not ashamed, but you know, like they start this kind of, oh, are you really, did you really change diapers? Oh, really? Do you bathe your children? Really? Like, you know, kind of, but then we go back to our, like, Swedish environment friends, and then he becomes really proud of himself. Yes, I am helping. I love my children.
A teacher from Syria, now living in Sweden, ending that report there from my colleague at the BBC, Nuala McGovern. It seems every time Ken Burns produces one of his epic multi-part documentaries, it jumpstarts a conversation. Baseball, the Civil War, jazz. People often stop what they're doing to see what Mr. Burns sees. His latest, produced with his collaborator Lynn Novick, is a 10-part series on the Vietnam War. Last night was episode 1, and something caught our attention. The story of Ho Chi Minh. He was, of course, the leader of the North Vietnamese Communist forces during the war against the United States and America's allies in South Vietnam. But it turns out Ho had a much more complex relationship with the U.S., stretching back decades. The World's History guy Chris Wolf has been digging in. And Chris, what did you find?
Well, let's start with the fact that he once lived here in Boston and New York City. He put to sea from Vietnam at the tender age of 21 to work as a cook on a steamship traveling around the world. More, I think, to see the world than out of desperation or poverty. He came from a middle-class family. And see the world he did. He lived in France, he lived in the UK, worked his passage over here, lived in New York and Boston.
Boston, I mean, what was he doing here?
Well, we don't know that much about it. He traveled back and forth under various names, so it's hard to keep track of. But we know for sure he worked at the Parker House Hotel here in Boston, where as a cook, he probably worked making such classics as the Boston cream pie and the Parker House roll, which were both invented at that establishment.
That's incredible.
Crazy to think.
Yeah. So what did he think about American politics? Was he as favorable to what he saw as he was to Parker House rolls?
Well, I think that's it's a really good point because, well, we don't know what he really thought about the nitty-gritty of, like, American party politics of the day. But for sure, he was a huge admirer of the American ideology, I want, for want of a better word, the idea of the revolutionary underdog people challenging imperial overlordship. You know, the founding myth of America and was still, like, hugely prevalent at the time was the idea that the people rose as one against a foreign tyrant, Great Britain, in America's case. And obviously, for a long time, this was a hugely potent symbol to colonial peoples around the world.
So if Ho Chi Minh embraced that American narrative, how did that affect his actions once he returned to Vietnam?
Well, actually, before he got back to Vietnam at the end of World War I, he was in Paris, ran into a lot of other Vietnamese nationalists. And they were inspired in particular by President Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, one of which centered on the idea of self-determination, that peoples of a right ought to be able to figure out who should rule them. So Ho Chi Minh and these other Vietnamese nationalists actually petitioned Woodrow Wilson at the Conference of Versailles, the peace conference after World War I, to try and get their country taken into consideration, but without success.
So Ho Chi Minh does return to Vietnam and launches the revolution when the Japanese occupied French Indochina during World War II. And I gather, again, he kind of turns to the U.S. for guidance.
Not just guidance, he's actually asking for arms and help. And the precursor of the CIA, the OSS, parachutes in a team to go check him out, basically, and check his bona fides. They decide, well, he's more of a nationalist than a communist. This is someone we can do business with. So there are follow-up teams with arms, ammunition, and trainers to show Ho Chi Minh's forces how to actually use these weapons and to use them with some effect against the Japanese.
How much did Ho Chi Minh talk about his kind of reliance on the United States and how much he was inspired by this country?
The opening words of the Declaration of Vietnamese Independence, which he read on September 2nd, 1945, as the Japanese Empire is crumbling in defeat. And he's quoting Thomas Jefferson, "All men are created equal. They are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." So there it is in black and white, a direct kind of appeal to the wider world, almost to say, look, this is part of a historic struggle against colonialism.
All right, so what about being a communist? I mean, some people saw him as more of a nationalist, less of a communist. Was he not sincere?
Well, there's a kind of a counterfactual argument here, Marco. People have taken it to the extreme to say that the U.S. somehow missed an opportunity to flip him because he was a nationalist first and a communist second, that somehow we could have avoided the Vietnam War. I think that's taking it a little bit too far, frankly. He was a committed communist from the 1920s. He was persecuted for it, yet stuck to his guns. So you can see that he was never going to be a natural ally for the U.S. in that part of the world. But that's not to say he ended his admiration and emulation of the founding fathers, because he and his top general, Vo Nguyen Giáp, closely modeled their war on George Washington's war against the British. Keep your army in being, avoid a catastrophic defeat, wear the enemy down, and eventually make it too expensive for your superior enemy to continue the war, break their will, as it were.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolf, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Finally today, we hear a lot about melting ice in stories about climate change, but we don't usually hear the actual melting ice. Now, from afar, icebergs seem like quiet places, but as they crack and melt and crumble, they vibrate. Douglas McHale is a glaciologist at the University of Chicago. He discovered that he could use a seismometer to record iceberg vibrations, speed them up, and then make them audible to the human ear. The sped-up recordings are what you'll hear in this next story, along with music that McHale created with the artist collective Luftwerk.
You're standing on an iceberg that's 100 miles long and 20 miles wide, and it's sort of like, oh, you know, nothing is going on here. But then you feel your feet vibrating. Once the iceberg breaks off the ice shelf, it begins to move by the ocean currents and by the winds. And as it does, it's sort of like a car that is trying to get out of a parking spot, but it doesn't really have a very good driver. So the iceberg is scraping along against the coastline and, you know, bits of its edge that might be the size of a city block with buildings on it are falling off. All of the scraping motion eventually leads to the vibrations that are the music on this public art space. I fell into this wonderful collaboration with artists absolutely accidentally. I had all these seismic recordings of when B-15, the iceberg I had been studying, which was the world's largest one, broke off in 2001. And I said, well, why don't you pretend that instead of them being vibrations from a seismometer, they're vibrations from a musical instrument. And they came back with this incredibly evocative piece of music, which is authentic to the actual nature of ice, authentic to the data, but the sounds go right to your heart as well as to your brain. You think about it, but you also feel it.
Wow, unreal. And glaciologist Douglas McHale there. This story was produced by Debbie Lockwood with help from the world's Daniel Gross. To hear more of these eerie ice sounds, head to PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.